Welcome to the Startup Addict Podcast. I'm Nick Swinburne. I've been starting companies for over 20 years now. I've had some big successes, like Zappos.com, and lots of failures. Regardless of the outcome, I'm still convinced there's nothing more addicting than trying to turn ideas into reality.
Welcome to the Startup Addict, episode 12. And today we're going to be talking about...
We don't know. We've been sitting here for about 45 minutes. We thought we had a topic. We decided it wasn't a great topic.
I got one.
All right.
Well, laid on us. Well, you could have told us this 45 minutes ago.
Sorry. I just wanted to surprise you. All right. Because you did so well last week with just the Q&A. And it was just rapid fire, right? So I was like, if we
take a
similar strategy, then maybe we'll get some gold.
I think you should, gold.
By
the look on Dennis's face, you should change we to I, because I don't think Dennis was in on this plan.
I don't know what you're talking about.
We. Yeah, Dennis really thought this through.
Dennis clearly did not think we had a topic.
Okay.
This episode is sponsored by Tiger.
Tigre.
Premium, world-acclaimed Asian lager, award-winning full-bodied beer born in Singapore.
And
delicious.
This was a sponsorship that we had to pay for. But a sponsorship nonetheless.
Thank you, Tiger.
Gracias.
All right, now that we're done with the business, what are we talking about? What's the topic?
Recently, there have been some occurrences within the faded brands world that got me thinking about this. So the question for today's podcast is...
Does Julio still have a job? Do we have to decide right now?
Right now. Do it.
Fuck. Dennis, it's your call. Flip a coin.
All right. Bottle cap.
Flip a quarter.
If it's upside down, Julio's fired.
No, it's right side up.
Yes.
Damn it. Right. I mean, yes.
How will I exit my business a few years down the line if I want to, and how will the responsibilities be transferred in such a case? So today's topic is going to be exit strategy.
Well, we just told you yours, right?
Yeah.
That is none of your business how your responsibilities will be transferred. That'll be after you're
gone. That's the exit strategy.
Flip a coin, do I want to go?
All right, that's a decent topic. It is somewhat relevant. And I think I was always guilty of not having an exit strategy other than it'll be big, someone will buy it, we'll go public, whatever. Like very, very general. I think sometimes there's like a thought that you're being kind of greedy or getting ahead of yourself if you start thinking about like those kind of things. Or it just sounds audacious to like, you haven't even started a company yet, or you're just starting a company and you're already going to start telling people or sound like you're planning on having an exit. So the first one I would say is, whether you verbalize it or not, you probably should know at each stage, and it could change, what you're hoping to have happen, right? So at Zappos, and when I was going through the first round of meetings with potential investors, I'm just remembering this right now, I'm pretty sure I didn't know what to say. Like if someone said, what's your exit strategy? I just kind of assumed that what they wanted to hear was, not even thinking about that. I'm focused about today and tomorrow, and I just want to make this thing big, and money's not important to me, and blah, 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 blah. That's what I assumed was the case. Learning from that, I think that's not necessarily the case. No one wants to hear that your primary focus on day one is how to get out of the business or how to sell the business, because I think they think you might be focusing on the wrong things. But, you know, having learned about it more, I think people, it's a plus if you can verbalize what you think could happen. And as long as you understand all the steps and the work that's involved with that and realistic about that, I think then it seems like, okay, let's thought it through. This is we're working towards something.
Is there red flags that you think about, like when you start thinking of exit strategy, like when you're building the business, is there a certain point when you're in it that you start thinking, man, maybe I should probably start figuring out how I can get out of this?
I mean, I have thought that. It's not usually been a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The business is like every one of your weekends. Come on, don't you have a dum-dum or something? Like, okay, give me something. Yeah.
Post.
Let's delete that part.
Hey, Dennis, go ahead and put that in.
No, I think so for me, the times when I would start thinking about that are, well, in the evolution, right? With Zappos, I started thinking about it because I wasn't as interested in the day-to-day. And I wanted to do other things, and I started to worry about the fact that maybe everything up until this point, the value was never going to be realized, right? So it became like this, like almost like anxiety of like, you know, the day-to-day work wasn't as interesting to me, so I couldn't get lost in that. So I was more thinking of this thing that I was just kind of in a rush to like make this worth something, right?
Yeah.
And then you start panicking in a situation like that where it's just not necessarily panicking, but all of us from the beginning were a little traumatized. Those of us that went into it hoping that it would not be the only place we ever worked in our lives, right? It was more like, man, I hope something happens. And I hope something positive happens. I hope nothing bad happens where all of this was for nothing. So that happens in companies that are just scaling. And it just feels like, you know, the way we were kind of raised through the Zappos process was that we were one step away from going out of business. But what was interesting was even within a company, right, there's a bunch of people with different opinions and thoughts at the same time. They're all working towards the same goal. They're all, you know, friends. They all share all these other interests. But like for us, for example, like I've said this before, but like Fred, you know, Tony would always say like, I want to keep this company private forever and just work here forever. And I was like thinking that sounded horrifying. And I was like, fuck, I want to do some other things. I want to see, like, you know, if I could get money for this right now, that'd be great. And I could move on and do other things. And I was afraid of, like, it not being worth anything, right? And then there's some people where it actually, you know, not everyone has equity, for example. So then it becomes a more awkward conversation where it's like, okay, that to them it's more about like stability and who will they be working for and like what will their role be. It's not even about a financial exit, right? I mean, generally it's not like in general a company's going to change hands and all of a sudden everyone's going to get a huge raise, right? They're going to, I mean, it could happen, but most likely it's going to be they're more worried about continuity or the thing they enjoy about work changing, and then it creates a whole nother set of dynamics or whatever, worrying about each of these things, right?
Yeah.
So it's never as simple as like, even companies where you read about it, it's like, and it's usually the people in the headlines or the people who get the credit or are the executives or founders, they might be the ones that are like talked about, but usually it really affects a whole lot of people. And then it turns into a whole range of emotions. I've kind of gone off topic here.
Yeah.
But I remember even at Zappos, it was like not sad, like depressing, whatever, but you felt bad for some people, right? They'd been there a long time. And maybe they either joined after equity was being handed out or it was in a position where there wasn't any, and it was just like, you know, everyone has that same sense of accomplishment and everyone works just as hard regardless of what their stake is. And so then it's like this weird moment where there's a huge disparity among the rewards people get.
Yeah.
And there's reasons for it, and everyone understands it, and everyone understands like how this person put themselves in position to start a company or have equity versus this person who didn't start the company or didn't have equity or whatever. But it doesn't make it any easier. It's still, you know, it's not like the people who It's not like the founders take more pride in their job or more pride in their company than the people who worked there, right? So in Zappos, we had people that had worked there for 10 years.
Yeah.
That it wasn't like a financial windfall. And so it was probably more stressful because they liked how things were going.
Yeah.
There wasn't any upside in them to being acquired by Amazon other than stability in theory.
So there, when exit strategies as a founder would, how it affects your employees takes a toll on, I can't even talk right now.
Well, no, I think
it affects your decision making because you also think about the employees that are.
Yeah, I mean, I think if any one person just has to think about in anything, if you just have to think about yourself or one thing, it's easier than if you have to take multiple people's thoughts and feelings and what happens to them into consideration, right? Yeah. I mean, if you were...
But it's much more difficult to do that, though, in a situation like Zappos, given that there were so many employees at the time. Yeah. Whereas if you had a smaller company, I guess it would be a little simpler to articulate to everyone who works there exactly the reasoning behind exiting when you guys decided to do so.
Yeah, I think yes and no. Because at Zappos, the vast, vast majority, only a small minority had any equity. So, like, the majority of people were kind of in the same boat and their concerns were kind of the same. Well, what happens to our work environment? What happens to my boss? What happens to my upward mobility? What happens to my, you know, what's going to change, basically? What's going to change from the time I walk into work to the time I leave work each day? And then in a small company, it's kind of the same thing, except in a way, it's not the same. It's kind of the same as, like, the conversations in our management meetings at Zappos and the different thoughts within that meeting, right? There was five or six of us. Like, the different things that came up and the arguments you would get into or the discussions you would get into weren't happening. So it didn't really matter if there was, on some level, if there was six of us or 2,000 of us. I mean, it affected people outside the six, but it was, you know, mostly the same thing. So if you had a six-person company, you could have the same exact scenario.
Yeah.
But anyways, in that scenario we're talking about, if you've got to the point where you've been offered an exit that is appealing to at least some segment of the company. But getting there is not the norm. It's something you can aim for, but, you know, not necessarily something you can plan on. You know, I listened to, I know Rob Dyrdek had a podcast where he talks about he's just shifted his whole strategy now to, like, on day one, he knows exactly what his plan is and exactly when and how he would want to exit a company. I mean, it was one of the short story longs. I remember listening to it. It made sense.
I was going to ask him what you felt was the percentage of entrepreneurs that go into a business with that in mind already.
Well, I think most entrepreneurs go into it with, I want to make money, and at varying stages of the company or varying, like, oh, something good happens, something bad happens, they are almost like watching inside their head this assumed money or status within the startup community or whatever it is, or they're daydreaming of those things on some level. I mean, it's maybe impossible not to. But what I learned from that was, okay, from that podcast in particular, was like, huh, okay. So I don't think I would be able to take the time before starting something to go through and figure out exactly what was going to happen from it. But it is probably a little bit, when I started looking at it, I realized it was a negative that I hadn't at least looked into, like, what I was going to be judged on. So lately, I've really been trying to get a handle, especially within, like, restaurants and food stuff, of, like, well, how will we be judged, and what are the metrics that above all else we should focus on? What was that? Your coffee splash?
My teacup.
Dude, you're gonna add that to your you should add that to your sound effects.
My teacup hit the microphone.
Oh, nice. So anyway, that's a big show. So that now I'm a firm believer that it almost seems crazy to me that I didn't know this. I still don't know it for some things, but I think everyone, it's one of the first things they should learn when they are working on an idea or about to launch a company, is, like, don't worry so much about, like, who exactly is going to buy you for what. I mean, I think there are some industries like that. It sounds like there's some, like, alcohol or things like that. It's like, hey, if you get to a certain size, one of these four companies is going to buy you for this multiple of sales or earnings or something. But in general, you should know, like, okay. Like, I was talking to someone today, and they said in the restaurant industry, you're going to be judged on your year-over-year growth in number of units and same-store sales. So that's what you should focus on. Like, those are the two main things you'll be focused on. And obviously, you'll be focused on your earnings, and you'll be focused on, you know, how could your concept, is it just in coastal cities? Could it go all the way across the country? But by and large, whether it's franchising or corporate-owned, there's going to be some investors that prefer franchising, some investors that prefer corporate-owned, but they're all going to, no matter what, want to know how quickly are you growing unit wise, and are is each you know, are the locations getting are the sales going up and you're getting more profitable at each location year over year? So I was like, okay, which nothing revolutionary. Probably everyone except me knew that, but at least it's you know, sometimes you make those decisions of like, well, let's not add any locations this year. Let's just refine. You could tie it to Basecamp, for example. Like, okay, so Basecamp, we've got five locations. What should we do? Should we focus on like making them all run more efficiently? Should we focus on seeing how high we can push the sales at each one? Should we, what should we, you know, and a lot of time we were thinking, or should we add more locations? And but I wasn't thinking, and I'm not even sure if, I'm assuming it's, well, it is the same, pretty much the same thing for fitness as restaurants. But we were never sitting there going, hey, we need to get here and we're going to be judged on how many we have. And so, yeah, it might make sense to take the next 6 months to work out some inefficiencies in these ones, but we also need to either double in size this year or we better have a really good story of what we accomplished in lieu of doubling in size or why we didn't do it. So sometimes, without knowing exactly what we'd be judged on, sometimes it's hard to figure out what the trade-offs are for a particular decision. You know, the apparel industry, for example. When we got into the apparel industry, we didn't really know how we'd be judged. We looked at it more like, if we can create designs that people seem to like, and if we can, this was dethroned, if we can sponsor fighters that can rise through the ranks and get us more publicity, then we should be able to find a partner. So our partner that we wanted was Tap Out, that would then take care of all the pain in the ass stuff like distribution and sales and customer service and warehousing and all that. And that was true. And we did get to that point for like a month until they sold the company and we got the brand back. But like, but then what? That wasn't an exit, right? That was just a, you know, we had this goal of if we do X, Y, and Z, it should be attractive to a company that has the infrastructure in place and has the bandwidth to take on another band and throw them into their system. Okay, so we did that. We got into the system. Now what? Well, we hadn't thought beyond that, so we didn't even know like what the trade-offs were. You know, maybe we would have found that like maybe if we would have known from the beginning, like, hey, that's, you know, that means that basically your upside is fully controlled by Tap Out. Like, if you're part of Tap Out's system, then yeah, maybe for you guys on a personal level, you don't have to deal with X, Y, and Z, but you're just a subset of Tap Out, and so whatever, you know, you can't then take that and get your own. You can't, you know, that limits you in like your future acquirers or your partnerships or whatever.
How big was Dethrone when you went to Tap Out?
When we went to Tap Out, Dethrone was probably doing probably $1.5 to $2 million.
How many people?
People wise, we were three or four.
So that when you sold it, you still were designing and everything, but
we didn't sell it. So the deal with Tap Out was just they bought all. We had a warehouse full of inventory. So the pitch was here: buy our inventory from us, and then take over sales, fulfillment, customer service, all that stuff. And I don't even remember what it was. And here's how we'll split the revenue. And then we were responsible for marketing. They were responsible for marketing to like wholesale accounts and that kind of thing. But we were responsible for like brand marketing. And
which is fighters and
Sponsoring fighters, whatever would make the brand desirable to the stores they were trying to sell to.
Yeah.
And they were taking over the online store fulfillment as well. And then we were also responsible for like our UFC fees. We had to pay those ourselves. But in theory, we should have become like a branding and marketing company. And our designs. That was like we could contribute designs. They would suggest designs. They would, you know, kind of like a hybrid approach. But it wasn't. It was more that business in that scenario wasn't the only person that would really ever acquire us would have been them, right? Or in theory, if we would have been farther along, whoever, if someone acquired them, and I think theirs was a little bit of a fire sale. Was, you know, and that was the issue. That was why it came on all of a sudden.
Yeah.
A lot of it was smoke and mirrors and and those kind of things. But we didn't know that, and so we.
So tap out was kind of the exit strategy, but not really.
I guess in a way, our exit strategy from Dethrone, well, it wasn't in a way. It's what we were hoping was that we would create a brand, which sparked some interest, which then we could take a big company, which we thought Tap Out was, and have them handle all the costly stuff, and that our royalty or however they paid us split of revenue would exceed what we had to do pay to, you know, on the marketing we're responsible for and on ourselves, and that it would just kind of be a fun thing that could get everywhere without us having to take all the risk.
Yeah.
We were never really thinking of like, how could we sell it? What would it ever be worth? If someone would have told me on average, like, how are apparel companies valued, I wouldn't have had any idea.
So when it actually came back to you, then you left it. What made you decide to exit out of it when it came back to you?
Well, it didn't. We came back to us. We decided to keep going.
And then you just kept that?
We decided to keep going, but we kept going without knowing. So then it turned out, I don't remember if we structured it as we licensed the brand to them or whatever we did. But basically what ended up happening was we had like a 3 or 4 year deal with them. And then this company, ABG, which the most arrogant group of guys ever, just complete dickheads. They were like...
how much of a dick? What do they do?
These guys, I think I've talked about this before.
Tell me when.
These guys, the first meeting we had with them, it was down their Tap Out office. And I think it was Dan, who was great. Great guy, punk ass. And then Mark, who was the CEO at the time. They introduced us to this guy from ABG. And we had met them at the UFC Fan Expo in Boston, I believe it was. Boston or Toronto. And we had a booth. And we basically had decided we were going to partner with Tap Out, but we hadn't done it yet.
Yeah.
So it was this timing of the show. So we were out there. We had a booth. The guy came by, and he was kind of like... You know, we had a bunch of fighters at the booth, and so he was kind of in, you know, fanboy mode with all the fighters. And then he...
Who were the fighters?
I don't remember off the top of my head, but he... And he had a son with him, and they were like, yeah, and they're like, yeah, we're going to... That was when we started talking about it. We're doing this deal with Tap Out. We're going to, you know, Dethrone will be great. We want to do this. We want to do that. I was like, oh, shit. Okay. No, so I guess that was after we knew about the deal. That doesn't make sense. I don't know anyway. Timing is... I have a hard time with time. Well... I guess they were doing the deal. It was they announced they were doing the deal. So they told us after Magic they were doing the deal. This show must have been right around the same time, and they said, we'll introduce you to these guys. Either that or they said, we're about to do a deal, you should meet these guys. Whatever the fuck it was. We met the guys, they seemed cool. And then we thought, okay, well, maybe whatever happens to Tap Out happens to us. At this point we didn't know it was a fire sale, so we thought this is probably a great deal for them, and maybe there's some scraps we could fucking have would be great for us. And then, so they called us down to the headquarters. So we had like a 3 year deal where they would do all the fulfillment and customer service. There was some minimum guarantees to us. So it was a good deal for us.
Yeah.
And they basically got in this meeting, and this guy said, Mark, CEO, said, introduce me to whoever the guy's name was from ABG. And he said, hey, this is Nick. The owner of Dethrone. He was also the founder of Zappos. And the guy was like, I've never met the guy. I might have told this story before on the podcast. I never met the guy. And the guy's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's get one thing straight. It's like, okay. Yeah, you just tell by the tone that some ridiculous fucking comment is coming. And he's like, you were not the founder of Zappos. You might have been one of the founders of Zappos, but you were not the founder of Zappos. First time I ever talked to this fucking guy. So I was like, huh. I think that's what I said. Huh. Okay. Not that I give a shit, but no, I was the founder of Zappos, but you know, whatever. You want to say I was one of, I don't fucking care.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, you were saying you're the, I'm like, yes, okay. He's like, well, what about, I've read about this Tony Hsieh. Okay, well, I can go into the whole story if you want. Like,
sit down.
And he's like,
pour some cocoa.
Okay, well, what about, at one point you guys worked with a banker from Bank of America. His name was blah, blah, blah. Do you remember him? I'm like, dude, I don't know what the fuck to tell you. So he just sat there. It was like a weird conversation, right? So basically what they said was like, no, you can just take your brand back. And we're like, we don't want our brand back. We started this brand with a specific goal of having a larger distribution partner. We've been working on this for a while. Because when I first approached Dan from Tapout, I said, hey, he goes, I kind of want to, but we don't have the bandwidth right now. And then he reached out again later and was like, hey, we've got, we just licensed out our brand. And we've still got our, you know, our sales team. We've still got our fulfillment center. We've still got this. Now we're ready to pull another brand into the mix and put our team to work on that. All right, great. So we did it. So anyway, the guy was like, no, you just take your brand back. We don't want our brand back. And so they're working on closing this deal. And so it's kind of a pain in the ass for them that they've got this 3-year liability out there to this other brand. So what ended up happening was they said, all right, fine. So we had shipped our inventory down there. And I think our inventory at cost was like, it wasn't a ton. It was maybe like a little under $100,000 or something. So they said, you can take your inventory back. We don't want our inventory back. We just fucking sold it to Tapout. Like, so they would sell it to their stores. We'll just take, okay, well, this is kind of this same kind of, we were just a nuisance to this cocky guy. So anyways, what ended up happening was we agreed to, they would pay us for the inventory and then we would take it all back. So that worked out. We were like, okay, fine. We've basically sold, you know, it's basically free now for us. We'll take it back. And then they gave us, I don't remember what the other terms were, but I know we ended up with the Tapout Sprinter van. So we're like, all right, fine.
Oh, sweet.
So,
and we'll throw in a van.
Yeah. So they drove down. I don't remember if it was Jeff or Rachel or Matt.
I'm assuming they used the van to ship everything. So they said, just
no. So they said, when do you want to come down and pick everything up? So we're like, I think we arranged to have the inventory shipped back to us. And then we had to go pick up the Sprinter. They said, we'll have it waiting for you. And at this point, you know, Punk Ass is like not, he doesn't, he's not in control anymore. Like ABG's taken over and he's like, you know, sorry, bro. Like, oh, you know, blah, 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 blah. And like, hopefully this makes, you know, hopefully this works out good for you guys. And at least you got your inventory back for free and blah, blah, blah.
And a Sprinter.
Yeah. Okay. So they go down there, they fly down to San Bernardino and they get there at like, they're just like, we're going to fly down and we're going to drive this fucking van back. So they get there at like, they get to the office at like, come in. Yep, we'll have it ready for you. Out there at 10 in the morning. And it was the ABG people there and they were sitting there like rifle, you know, going through the office. They were just like kind of taking over the offices and all that. Okay. We'll have it ready for you in a minute. And then it was like an hour later, like, hey, I need proof of insurance. Gave him the proof of insurance. Okay, I'll be right back. And these fuckers made him sit there, I think, until like 7-8 o'clock at night.
Fuck off.
Just to be dicks.
Dick!
The ABG guys. And then, so finally, like, after sitting down there for fucking flying down and being ready to leave at 10 o'clock, they like it was like 7-8 o'clock at night. They left and drove home.
Oh, God.
Well, they still took off.
Who?
They still took off. They still drove.
They still got the van and brought it back.
I would have been like, no, I'm taking, go grab a hotel room. I'll see you in the morning.
Yeah.
Eat some pancakes and I'll see you in the morning.
But I remember how talking about this. But, anyways, that was more. Function. So that was the sidetrack story, but the point of it was we got into that apparel business without knowing. We had a plan. So we had a plan that worked, but the plan wasn't an exit. The plan was to align ourselves with a partner so that in theory we could just enjoy like the fun side of a brand and make a living off of that without having to deal with all the other stuff. And so we got to that, but that wasn't an exit. Unfortunately, that wasn't an exit. That was just a step in
that direction.
Yeah, and then we didn't realize that the situation they were in and what that would, you know, force them to do with these guys and then how that would affect us. And so then when we got it back and we just thought, well, shit. We didn't really want to, you know, we weren't planning on having to, like, be responsible for sales and warehousing and all that stuff. We did it for a little bit in the beginning with an eye towards getting out of it.
Yeah.
And now we've got it back with no eye towards ever getting out of it again. But we liked the brand. We didn't want to stop. So we just kept doing it. And
how long did you do it after you got everything back?
Well, I kept going. I mean, it's still my brother.
Well, how long did you do it until you decided that you wanted to exit?
I kept doing it until. So we had a warehouse in Burlingame. And then. No, we had a warehouse, I think. Yeah, the warehouse in San Carlos was before that. After we got it back, we got a warehouse in Burlingame. I kept doing it. I was working on a couple things, but I was still working on Dethrone until, I'm terrible timing-wise, I would say 2 years ago, maybe. My brother.
Something like that. I remember because when I got into the agency, it was still part of what we were doing. So yeah. It might have been afterwards.
So basically 2 years ago, my brother was like, hey, you're not really into this. You're only focusing on it a little bit. I love it. And he had come on board at some point and was, you know, more passionate about it and thinking about it more and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I just want to keep going with this. And so eventually he just kind of bought out the whole thing and took it over. So it's all his now.
Yeah.
And so he runs it. And so his, so he has a different, I shouldn't really speak for him, but he has a different perspective. He's not hoping for an exit.
Yeah.
He's just, it's what he likes to do. And he looks at it like, I'm going to run this business. And as long as this business supports me and my family and, you know, a handful of employees, then I'm happy. Like that's great. Like I want it to just, if I could do that forever, I would do that forever. So that's an example of, if you don't have to have an exit strategy in theory, if you don't want to exit.
Yeah.
It just would be helpful all the way along the way to know, if I did want to exit, what would I be judged on? So that while you're living the, you know, running a lifestyle business, you're at least could know that if you change your mind, at least you've been focusing on the right things. Which, you know, which again, like I look back and I go, okay, most decisions you regret are based on that, like Basecamp. And I, you know, Basecamp's going great, and it's going great from a revenue perspective and profitability perspective. But the one thing we can't get away from is the fact that gyms 2 through 5, we spent way too much money opening them.
Yeah.
Right. And so the logic there was, well, it's just like, if I can afford it, or not so much me saying I can afford it, someone else saying, eh, he can afford it and
yeah,
he'll probably fucking do it, then in theory, it should just be that, like, that only affects me, or, you know, we spent too much money. But it's not, because now it's like, that's how we get judged when people look at us. Like with the gross sales and the profit, if we had opened these things for like a reasonable amount of money, we'd be in a great position.
Yeah,
we're still in a good position, but we're not in a great position. So everyone we've met, whenever we meet with any investors, whether it's us reaching out to someone or someone reaching out to us, it's always, why'd you spend so much on opening that gym? Did you, you know, could you do it for cheaper? And it's much harder then to be like, of course we could do it for less.
Because now you have to go prove that you can.
And then, yeah, then it's like, do you prove it? But then that takes time.
Yeah.
So like, then you kind of find yourself in like, I could do it, but, and here's how I would do it, but it's still different than if you had done it. So, you know, what it does is it limits your potential investors or acquirers from everyone who's saying, okay, yep, all your metrics are in line with what we would look for, to someone who has to be a little more visionary that can go, yeah, I see it. Like, I'm more impressed with these two numbers, and I know, I understand completely how you ended up spending too much money on opening those gyms, and I know from experience that you could do it for less, therefore I'm not going to really hold that against you.
So, well, you're relying on...
Yeah. Well, they are going to hold it against us.
Well, that I'm saying is you're relying on finding the right investor, as opposed to if you had done it the right way before, then it's just a matter of reading the numbers.
Yeah. Now we have to find someone that is specifically passionate or interested in fitness versus having access to anyone that's just looking for
a portfolio
these X numbers. And it's not like you could sit there and you're like, I don't understand. You can get frustrated sometimes, right? And be like, I don't understand. Why doesn't everyone, we've already told them why we spent too much, and they should know we could do the next one for less. But like, it's not their job to, you know, they need to have discipline in their job too. And so if they were to sit there and every opportunity they looked at, listen to, even though they're logical arguments, if every time they listened, yeah, you're right, that's right, that's right, then they'd be off, you know, they had to set some guidelines for themselves. Like, hey, if I only invest in things that have done X, Y, and Z, then.
Yeah, they have to see it.
Yeah. So that makes sense. And then I would say the other thing, that knowing what you're going to be judged on ahead of time, the other way that that becomes helpful later is you've kind of looked at it. In theory, you've looked at it that way the whole time, right? What happens if you don't know, if you haven't decided from the beginning, here's the three, four, or five, or two metrics we're going to be judged on, and let's track against that the whole time, then it's human nature to kind of like either base it on what you want it to be worth. Like, I want it, you know, you could have a situation where you could have a business that's doing well, and it might have taken a while to find its way, right? Or you might have made some mistakes in the beginning. So you've spent more than it's worth. But like, you know, that's not the end of the world. It's just an investor or an acquirer is not going to give you credit for what you've, when you spent too much, right? So that's hard sometimes, because you might be like, hey, I've spent a dollar. And they're like, and I know now that I could have done it for 75 cents, but I've spent a dollar. Great. I'm glad you learned your lesson. But, I'm sorry that you spent a dollar.
But here's 65
cents. And I will give you 75 cents because that's what it's worth. And then it's like, that's a tough one, right? So do you, it's almost, it feels like, if, you know, it depends. If you're selling the company, then it is. If you take less than that, then you have lost money, right?
Yeah.
Which still might be the right thing to do in some cases. I was listening to a podcast. What podcast was I listening to? But it was someone, one of the companies from Shark Tank that Mark Cuban had invested in. And they were saying that he has a different approach. His approach is basically, he's not worried as much about maximizing the upside. He's more worried about reducing the downside. So like, I'm just paraphrasing what I think I remember hearing, but if you have a $10 company and you think that by taking some risks, you could make it into a $20 company, but that if everything doesn't work out perfectly, instead of having a $20 company, you might have a $5 company. Or you could take a $10 company and turn it into a $12 company, and your downside is like, if it doesn't work out perfectly, you might be a $9.75 company. That the way he approaches things is, well, dude, go for 12, and worst case, you're at 9.75. He's not as much into the go for 20. I can't remember what the phrase he kept saying is basically, don't worry about getting to a billion, worry about going to zero, I think is what the guy said he kept telling him in their instance. Which, you know, now I think whatever it was at broadcast.com, he sold it like for a shitload of money, which doesn't make, you know, never made any sense how much he sold it for, but he sold it at the time. There was probably people being like, oh, don't sell yet, you can get more later, blah, 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 blah. So it's one way of looking at it, but that can also be the wrong way to look at it too, right? Because you might miss out on opportunity.
Yeah.
Same way if you have five gyms and you think, oh, I'm going to be judged on how many gyms. If I have five today, I'm going to be judged on how many I have a year from now. I don't want to try to open five more because, like, what if they don't work? But then if you don't go from five to 10, then
you're not
going to be worth any more than you were today, right? So you have to, like, everything seems to be a trade-off. But if you don't understand what those two, three, four things are, then it's impossible to make these decisions.
Yeah.
And you could end up, which I've done, making decisions that later you're like, fuck, well, if we only would have known that.
I should have opened five gyms.
And I do remember in Basecamp along the way, I remember us having conversations about what will be looked at better or worse. Like, should we sign a lease where the rent is higher, but we get less money up front, so it's going to cost us more to get open, but in theory, we'll have a chance to be, you know, our numbers will look better later because our rent will be lower. Or should we be going for higher rent with nothing up front, right? And it was kind of like there's some balance in there, but we were cognizant, is that a word? We were cognizant of the fact that we needed to, that there was a trade-off between these two numbers, but we'd never actually done enough research into exactly how each would affect us, and then made a decision like, no, above all, we should worry about X, Y, Z.
Not only is it a word, it's a good word.
Good word.
It's a damn good word.
Smart word. There's only two of us at this table that could have thrown that word out there.
I was like, that's not a word. That is definitely not a word.
Dennis earlier was like, when we didn't know what we were going to talk about, we're like, I thought we knew what we were going to talk about. We don't know what to talk about. Dennis is like, listen, here's what we're going to do. You guys talk for a bit. We'll make fun of each other. I'll say meow, then yell pussy, and then we're done.
Yeah, good.
We're like,
that's the way to close a show.
So, what else about that? So, yeah, and then the other thing is, you know, if you're taking on a partner, so if you're, then, you know, it's important to both understand the, or however many, understand. It's, and I think it's important for the whole team to understand as many of those metrics as possible and understand what they're working towards, which is really no different than hiring someone and giving them a clear understanding of, like, here are the things you're going to be judged on. So whether it's a company, knowing what in the future investors will judge it on, or an employee taking the time to make sure that they've asked and know what their boss is going to judge them on later. It's kind of the same thing, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, when you're in school, they tell you, hey, you know, fuck, half your grade's going to be based on your test results, half it's going to be based on your attitude, and half
the other half
a third is going to be
your attendance,
40% is going to be your how you do on these on your book report, 40% is going to be how you do on these on the final, and 20% is going to be on your attendance, right? Yeah. You know that, so then you know, like, fuck attendance, because I'm going to nail the book report, the test,
do the percentage,
get a C,
you know, or whatever it is. So yeah, I guess it's like, it's, you know, another example of, doesn't really matter what, you know, they're just, everything's just the same stuff, you know, it's like the same basic skill set. It's hard to, you know, it'd be hard to run if you didn't know what your goal was, right?
Yeah.
If your goal's like, run a mile as fast as you can, because then 2 miles will be easier. That's easier than, okay, just go.
Go, and I'll say stop.
Start running. I'll tell you when to stop.
Whenever.
You know, be fucking torture.
I want to stop now.
In fact, it's true. You know, at the base camp the other day, the, I don't know if the power went out or the TV turned off for some reason, right? So when you're on the bike, with the Aerodyne bike, for the minute, you're looking at the screen, and it's telling you, like, how much time you got left, right? And so sometimes you're like, oh, I'm so fucking tired, but you look up, oh, it's okay, there's 20 seconds left. And or even if there's 40 seconds, there's always a stage where you become aware of, like, where you are, and it makes it manageable what you're doing. But I swear, when the TV went off, and it's still a minute, but without knowing, like, where you were in the minute, or it made it, like, a lot harder, right?
And what's the backup on that? The trainer just keeps an eye on the clock, or?
In that situation, I think Helene was yesterday.
What do you, like, get your...
She just looked at the clock, I think, and was like, okay, you know, and so it probably wasn't exact. Whenever she looked at the clock, she had to then figure out...
Remember where she was.
And roughly this, and then someone came and turned the TV back
it's
on.
It's been 2 minutes.
Somebody hit the off button?
I don't remember what happened. It just went off real quick.
Uh-oh.
But it...
The main ones, right?
Main one, yeah. It might have been a month ago. Okay. But it was something that was fixed as soon as the... she had to keep teaching class, so she couldn't look into it. But as soon as someone from the front was aware of it and came over, they fixed it pretty quick. But it, I remember saying to the person next to me, like, dude, when you can't see the clock, that minute is like unbearable because you have no idea where you are in the minute. It's the same as anything, right? The only example that wouldn't make sense, I guess, is sometimes it sucks in the middle of the night when you wake up and you look at the clock, you know what time it is. You'd much rather not know. So sometimes on purpose, you're like, I'm not going to look at the clock because I don't want to fucking know that.
Oh, I know. Every train. I hear the train every morning, so.
Oh, yeah. I'm bombarded by the train all the time, too.
You know, but it's easier if you're eating dinner and you know that they've got great desserts. You're going to take it a little bit easier during dinner versus if you have no fucking idea what's coming up and you eat all the bread and then you eat all the eat all the food and you do this and then you get to dessert and you're like, fuck, that was the reward? Well, I'm too stuffed to... Too stuffed to get to, like, eat the dessert.
It's like those steakhouses where they put all this nice heavy foods before they bring the meat out.
Yeah.
Those like Brazilian steakhouses. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I go in there starving.
You keep your flag up and say, like, bring me more meat.
fuck the salad bar.
Yeah.
I'm here for protein.
But anyway, so it's all, it's basically that. You know, you don't want to get bloated on the wrong things, not be able to, to not be in prime position for ice cream.
Well,
so Dennis says he really misses pizza right now.
Oh God, this keto thing.
Yeah, so Dennis and Julio are both on the keto diet.
You guys haven't even noticed how much weight I lost.
Now, granted, Tiger beer is not necessarily keto friendly, and we are, you know, I don't think I'm the only one having one right now. Julio seems to be doing a good job of sticking to it. Dennis, on the other hand, is on the keto diet, but always back on it today.
I lost weight. Nobody noticed, but it's all right.
Well, it's because you're always wearing like a button-up flannel.
Yeah.
Now it's like t-shirt time now. T-shirt time.
It'd be sad. Nobody noticed.
So we got enough track. I guess the only other thing in there is picking a partner. This should be, a thing to talk about, both knowing. The most helpful thing you can do is both figure out, like, what you're going to be judged on and what you both want out of it.
Do you have to like your partner? Is that important? Personally? I think
it's probably pretty important.
Okay, good. Good to know.
I mean, you're going to spend a lot of time with them. You're going to have to be honest with each other.
Well, that goes back to what you were talking about in the previous episode. How
was Dennis just saying he doesn't like us?
He kind of looked at you right in the face, too. He looked at you.
He looked at me and did that, and I was like, I'm not your fucking partner.
Do you have to like them?
There's three of us here, Dennis. This is a threesome, not a partnership.
Ugh. Well, you said in the previous episode.
Right here. There's chocolate.
You said in a previous episode that there's a difference between getting a partner with a skill set, so someone that you actually need, if you need a piece of code or you need someone to write you some, as opposed to somebody that is really passionate about your idea and wants to go, full bore on the idea with you. Do you have to like somebody that essentially is going to work for you? Would be a better question.
I mean, I think in any situation, if you were to interview someone and you didn't like them,
they're not getting hired.
I don't think it's a very good idea to hire them.
but he writes really good code.
I mean, maybe if it's going to be like a, it's going to be like
really good at it.
Working remotely and you never have to talk to him.
I fucking hate you, but he writes really good code.
Early on at Zappos, we had a developer. This was back when, I probably said this already, but this was back when they would deliver you your website on a CD-ROM, right?
Yeah.
Damn.
And then you'd load it onto the server. I don't think it was a floppy disk. I think it was a CD-ROM. Might have been a fucking floppy disk at that point. But with this guy, I could be wrong. I think his name was Charles. And he was crazy. But crazy, not like literally crazy, just very emotional. And I don't remember what he was irate about, but I remember he came storming into the... This was pretty soon after we moved into the Venture Frogs offices in San Francisco. And he came storming in, and he's just ranting and raving. And he's just... I think it was like it was harder than he thought. He wanted to get paid more, and whoever he was talking to was saying, no, we already had a deal. This is how much we're going to pay you. And he's just holding this fucking CD-ROM and just waving it back and forth, and... We're all just sitting there like, almost like in the movies where the kid's like, holding a vase and they're going to fucking drop it or something. We're like, dude, if he just crushes that thing right now, we're done. Like, that's our whole fucking website. There's no cloud we can log into. I can still picture that. So he did not like us. And that did not work out well.
How sick was the website, though?
It was all right.
It was a really good website.
I think it was...
You should have just smashed it, right? Snap it.
I think actually that was immediately we hired an in-house developer at that point.
Is that crazy? Back then, no cloud. There's no real way. Like, once you write it, that is it. And you got to make other physical copies.
Another funny story, another random story, which has nothing to do with anything, but it reminded me of... that was when we were in... Tony had a penthouse apartment that was serving as the incubator while the offices were getting done. So we were in there. And there was another night. So in Zappos, we partnered with Shoe Pavilion. Shoe Pavilion was like a shoe store.
It's like Payless.
Athletic shoes. Yeah. Kind of like discounted athletic shoes.
Yeah. XJ 5000s. I don't know if anybody knows those shoes. Okay. Never mind.
So we had on our site at the time, when we first started, we were doing dropship, and so we had a feed. Actually, we weren't doing dropship. We were doing dropship originally, but with Shoe Pavilion, we weren't doing dropship. Basically, we did a deal with them where we set up an office in their warehouse. I think Matt Well, no, we haven't had him on here, but we've talked. You guys have met him. He was over there. He set up. He basically was assigned a Shoe Pavilion, and he set up in their warehouse. And when we get orders, he was responsible for getting them from their warehouse and shipping them. And the problem was in the beginning of Zappos, we had coupons, which, you know, that's not part of the revisionist history. That's not part of the story, you know. But the way we were, one of the first ways we were trying to get customers was saying, like, hey, here's $10 off, $10 off, $10 off, $10 off. And so we had a $10 off coupon. So we had to make sure, because Shoe Pavilion had a lot of discounted shoes, that and it kind of sucked, even if someone ordered like a $19.99 shoe, but it felt worth it just to acquire a customer. But we had to make sure that anything that was under $10, we definitely had taken out. And at that point, the feed we're getting is an Excel sheet. Yeah. Right.
Oh, Jesus.
And so then we're uploading that into the site, or importing that to the site, whatever. So we have to go through and just manually like make sure. So someone at some point there was like a men's kids soccer cleat. And also they had an inventory count. But at that point, I don't remember exactly, but there was a lot of manual stuff to do with that. Like we had to keep an eye on the ones where it was basically like if there was less than 10, we were also supposed to hide those. But it was like the perfect storm where somehow we let slip through a kid's soccer shoe that was listed at $9.99 and they only had like 5 of them or something, right? And we get we have a $10 off coupon. So someone on a coupon site posted, and this happened quick, like we refreshed the feed that morning and like that afternoon we're like, you know, oh shit, what's going on? And like,
it was like free shoes.
And it wasn't, I don't remember how to explain it or exactly, but it wasn't something where we knew and there was an easy way to fix it. It was just like mayhem. And so I think we ended up getting like, someone posted it on a site and said, hey, basically you get a free pair of soccer shoes if you use this coupon on the site for this product. And we didn't have it set to, hey, when they're out of stock, stop selling them. It would just keep taking orders.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I don't remember what it was. I think it was like maybe 200-300 orders for this shoe, right? Now, and also at this point, if we got an order, the customer service process was look at the order, print it, and then based on printing it, type that person's email address into your email, your Outlook, and fucking email them. So we were in the apartment, and we're like, holy shit. We finally got the thing up. By the time we caught it and got it off the site, we'd sold, however, a couple hundred. Now we have a couple hundred people who thought they were getting a free shoe, and they're not. And it might even have been more than that. It was really bad, whatever it was. I just remember we're sitting there. It was probably midnight. I think it was like me, Matt, and Farner, and friend John Farner. We were like, we're just basically going through the stack and one at a time emailing people saying, sorry, we don't have your shoe, but here's another fucking coupon to make up for this free fucking shoe you got. And of course, the people that didn't get a free shoe are going to be more pissed than the people that didn't get a regular shoe, you know, whatever.
But you gave out those 5 shoes free.
Yeah, whatever they were. And so then Alfred, and we still were giving away free because we had to give away more free coupons to make up for it. But Alfred, who was at the time was the other partner of Venture Frogs, I think at that point he was the VP of finance for Tell Me Networks, and later he would become our CFO and COO once after he moved to Vegas. But he walked through the office, and he's pretty matter of fact kind of guy. And so he walked in, he's like, "What are you guys doing?" Which is rare that he actually said that much. We fucking sold this. You know, the shoes got through, and it basically was free. You know, we explained the story, and he's like, And we're at this point, we're really pissed and frazzled, and we don't want to be there. And we're like, this is, and we're worried at this point, like, oh my God, there's going to be 300, 200, 300 people that are mad about us. This could kill the whole business. And he just looks at us and he's like, this process doesn't seem scalable. And he turns around and walks out. Well, the three of us are sitting there with a stack of like 300 fucking pieces of paper trying to figure out. And then, but what was great about it was we were like so frustrated and pissed. And then when the door shut behind him, we all looked at each other and we just started laughing. Like, what the fuck?
We've gone crazy. You know,
thanks for fucking restating the obvious, jerk. But no, he's a nice guy. But it was funny. Like, that was what it was like back then. It was like, you know, your fucking site was on a fucking CD-ROM, and if the developer crushed it, it was gone.
Yeah.
Your orders were coming through and like a really from an Excel sheet, and like if manually someone had to make sure that there was nothing under a certain price, and once it was on there, it wasn't, there certainly wasn't one little button to click to get it off. Like it was a fucking, even, you know, the e-commerce site was a pain in the ass to
a lot to of change. Parts.
It was 200 yeah. unhappy kids. They wanted soccer cleats.
200 yeah. shoeless kids.
Right, yeah. It was like, it was probably, yeah, 200 people with no kids ordering free soccer shoes so they could put them on eBay for $4. But anyways, that has nothing to do with knowing
exit strategy. Or business partner.
Although it did let us know, hey, we better, A, well, I guess part of it was like, hey, we are focusing on service. You know, we fucked this thing up and we're taking the time in the middle of the night to email all these people instead of just saying, sorry.
Yeah.
But also, it was a kick in the ass that, like, hey, to succeed, we better get some better systems in place.
This is not scalable.
Yeah. It was funny. I don't, the story doesn't do it justice. Cause I can picture in my head, but just this look of like rolling his eyes, looking at us and going, this doesn't seem scalable.
Spin around.
Yeah, we should just fucking shut down the whole business then. Fuck it. What are we here for? Let's go.
It is the end of Zappos as we know it.
That might. I've been looking at the clock over there. I hope I didn't start telling that story 20 minutes ago. I don't think so.
No, I think it's.
But
on that note, I guess that wraps up episode number 12.
Wait, I should still come into work tomorrow.
Yeah, thanks for saving Dennis. Yeah. Since when does Dennis recap what we talked about at the end of an episode?
I just started it in there. It's getting late.
Dennis is like,
T-Gray's biting.
That
saved my job.
Episode 12. Let me recap what happened for the first time.
Let me recap. So, exit strategy, I guess.
Exit strategy is, all right, thank you for listening.
Get out.
Like to follow us on Instagram. At the Startup Addict.
We got 2 new subscribers, by the way.
On YouTube?
Yes.
Holy nice. We appreciate shit. Both of you.
Might be my mom.
If anyone else can please subscribe on YouTube right now, you just search for the Startup Addict and then hit the subscribe button. And then soon enough, you'll be able to type in a custom URL.
Oh, can't wait.
We appreciate everyone listening and subscribing on iTunes. Had another great week there. And thanks for continuing to listen to us. You guys rubbed off on me there. I just completely lost my mind. Anyways, that's it.
Yep, that's it.
See you next week.
Okay.